On the edge of the South Bronx, people line up on a cold afternoon for $1 slices of pizza. There's a man shouting in Spanish, and he's wearing a placard for a pawn shop. And everybody I talk with has an opinion about guns.
Yeah, they should be controlled.
Why?
Because there's too many people getting killed, you know what I mean? A lot of people have guns, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They can get it very easy.
Well, the streets, I've seen people pull them out before. I've seen a lot of things, you know? But me, myself, I wouldn't deal with the guns. You know, I already know what type of problems they, you know, arise from that.
Because too many people get them, the wrong people get them in their hands. Kids wind up murdered for no apparent reasons. Innocent kids.
If I was the government, I really come out with some type of strict, you know, about people owning guns. Because honestly, they got a lot of people that's out here that's, you know, really ill. And they get their hands on guns. And that's what's, you know, that's the problem.
Oh, I hate guns. I have a fear of guns, actually.
When did you develop this fear?
When I was robbed and shot at my store about 20 years ago.
Wow. How many robberies have you seen at gunpoint, aside from this one?
Just the one that I experienced.
What happened specifically?
They came in, they looked like hoodlums, but I didn't panic. My gut instinct was to leave, but something said no. And sure enough, the guy bent down, there were three of them, he pulled a gun out, and he told me there's a holdup or whatever. Can't remember exactly, but I know that I gave him the money and I said to him, just don't shoot me, I want to live. I was positive, I wasn't negative, like I don't want to die. But as he was stepping off, I could feel him, I heard the trigger, shot right through, bullet exited. So that's where the fear comes from.
So how have you dealt with this fear in the years, in 20 years since?
Gosh, how have I dealt with it? The best way I know how, which is, probably trying to push it back in the memory, you know what I mean?
So you actually believe a businessman should have a gun to protect his business?
Why
is that?
Because, you know, at least, you know, you're there, you're protecting your property, you know, the things that, you know, your business. Like, if, you know, somebody's coming in there to try to, you know, rob you or hurt you, a lot of times people go in there and they don't even get any type of money and they hurt you anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so I believe that, yeah, you know, you should own a gun if, you know, depending on the circumstances that we live in. You know, now, I'm a regular guy in the street, I shouldn't have a gun.
Aurora, Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech. We're shocked by the massacres and the loss of life, but how did we get to this? This is the first of a two-part program that will try to answer that question. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears. Episode 1, Guns Part 1.
I was about 24 years old, I remember, and I lived in Chicago at the time, and I had a boyfriend who was interested in shooting ranges, and he took me once to one, and it never occurred to me to shoot a gun even.
Before she was the acclaimed author of Suns and Other Flammable Objects, poor Chista Kakpour fell in love with guns. In an essay for Slate published in December, Kakpour wrote that she thrived on the attention, even posting a series of sexy shooting range photos on MySpace.
I had grown up, you know, reading a lot of, like, Westerns, and, you know, and I'm also an immigrant, and there's something very American about the whole thing. I've always been interested in sort of American paraphernalia, and it felt like another step there, and it started to get more and more serious for me. Initially, like, I remember, you know, at that first shoot there, the first experience at the shooting range, my boyfriend took a lot of photos and we like uploaded them to like MySpace.
A shoot in two senses of the word.
Yes, exactly. A shoot in both senses. And so I thought, like, you know, they were on MySpace and like he was like, oh, they look so sexy and stuff like that. And then, you know, it seemed sort of funny to me at first. And then as years went by, I really got very serious about it, to the point where, you know, up to recent years, I really, really considered seriously getting a gun. And like living in Santa Fe where I live now, like, you know, I would think once in a while, like, well, it could be very, it's great. Like, I have a dog, and he runs outside, and there's coyotes. Like, I would need to shoot a coyote if something happened. And I had all these justifications, really elaborate ones.
Did you feel that you were objectifying yourself when you were putting yourself into these sexy photos with a gun, uploading these photos to MySpace? I mean, gun shows these days do use women in a role where they're very sexy.
Sure.
Gaston Glock, this was a huge strategy that he used when he actually flooded the American market with Glocks and so forth.
Sure, we have such a fascination with that, I think, with like femininity and then like objects of traditional like virility. And I remember, the photos got a lot of attention. And then I remember, like, years before that, seeing photos of women in Iran with machine guns and thinking, like, ooh, that's sexy. They're wearing, like, veils and chadors, and they're, like, holding machine guns. That's really sexy. Or, like,
Israeli army, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We always think that's sexy. I mean, I think about, like, in the piece I even mentioned, MIA, you know, and we think, you know, she's so subversive and cool because she sort of adopts a sort of violent militarism that, you know, nobody really even knows what's going on in Sri Lanka, but we just kind of like her swagger, you know? And so,
why do you think a woman with a gun is considered to be a more empowered figure, or is this a gender neutral issue?
No, I do think there, well, I was interested in the gender angle particularly, but I think it's like, it's that interesting balance between the Bond girl versus James Bond, and the gun kind of takes you, you know, you are kind of the Bond girl for a second, and then you kind of become James Bond. So for me, there was something like almost feminist about like being a female gun owner, and I kind of sensed that in the articles about Nancy Lanza. Obviously, I didn't know her, but in the articles, the way they would refer to her speaking to men at bars and sort of trying to impress them, and she's really into like craft beers. I've always been into craft beers. You know, she kind of had all these interests in like traditionally male things, and that really struck a chord with me in a big way.
So what was the turning point? What was the moment where you said, you know what, guns aren't for me?
The turning point, there was a couple. Well, I had a fiancé at one point who was just appalled at my interest in guns. He was just like, you know, I don't think we could live together if you had a gun in the house. And I would like belittle him all the time, and I thought it was really awful. But I realized, you know, I'd rather live with him, you know, than have a gun. So I would put it off. And then I think a lot of these cases, one by one, had a sort of cumulative effect, like Newtown. And I have to, you know, this is kind of a sad thing to admit, but I think until Newtown, I became obsessed with the coverage on that, and I just started reading everything on it. I think I was never sure that I would not own a gun. And that for me was just, there's no way to not explore the gun angle there. There's no way to say that's not about guns. You know, to me, that argument that I keep hearing, you know, it's people, not guns, just seems incredibly ignorant. You know, the guy had a mental illness, and his mother had like military grade weapons in her house. It's clear that if he had had a knife or anything like that, you know, those children would be alive. So
1776 will commence again if you try to take our firearms. Doesn't matter how many lemmings you get out there on the street begging for them to have their guns taken. We will not relinquish them. Do you understand? That's why you're going to fail, and the establishment knows, no matter how much propaganda, the Republic will rise again when you attempt to take our guns.
Federalists, at least, in Washington in particular, recognized that a militia could not take on a European standing army. Militias had certain functions to play, but they were not good at the kind of protracted military campaigns that needed to be waged in the American Revolution. So it is sort of funny to hear people like the person on who's ranting at Piers Morgan on CNN,
Alex Jones,
about, you know, 1776 will rise again. He couldn't possibly be referring to the militia, because if we had had to depend solely on the militia, we'd all be having tea at 4 o'clock and singing "God Save Our Gracious Queen." Because
I was trying to figure out what he was referring to.
Right, and I'm sure he must not have been referring to the fact that we needed the French Navy to help us out. That certainly couldn't have been what he was saying.
Yeah.
We'll bring back 1776, which means we'll need the French Navy to help us accomplish our ends.
Saul Cornell is a professor of American legal history at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia. He points out that the Second Amendment has a good deal more to it than the right to keep and bear arms. You state unequivocally at the beginning of your book, the original understanding of the Second Amendment was neither an individual right of self-defense nor a collective right of the states, but rather a civic right that guaranteed that citizens would be able to keep and bear those arms needed to meet their legal obligation to participate in a well-regulated militia. Why then have recent Supreme Court decisions like Heller and McDonald made efforts to broaden this civic right beyond this initial understanding?
We have to distinguish between the history, the evolving history, the history since the 1791, and contemporary gun politics. So let's begin with the history. The Second Amendment, if you read it holistically, if you make the whole text come to life, is about keeping and bearing arms in a well-regulated militia. It's a holistic principle. I think we see in contemporary debate people tending to erase the first clause and treating it as if it's just about the right to bear arms. But it is, in fact, about a well-regulated militia and the right to keep and bear arms in that militia. What we forget, for instance, is in the first Bills of Rights, there was a right not to bear arms. You know, that's worth pausing over. What does it mean, a right not to bear arms? It means that because bearing arms was an obligation, the state could force you to do it. Couldn't force you to pray, couldn't force you to speak, couldn't force you to assemble, could force you to bear arms. It was vital to balance that right to bear arms with the right not to be forced to bear arms. That's been completely lost from the way we think about it today. Now, the right of self-defense is as old as English common law, and one might argue, obviously, since it was understood to be a modification of a natural right, it's fundamental to Anglo-American law. There's no question about that. That, in fact, is one of the best arguments about why the Second Amendment had nothing to do with that. It was so well established. There was absolutely no legal challenge to it in the 18th century. It would have been odd that they would have thought to constitutionalize it. Now, having said that, their notion of what that right meant was very narrow compared to the fairly expansive way we understand it today. The obligation under English common law is to retreat to the wall, in fact, before you can respond with deadly force. In your home, a man's home is his castle. Under English common law, you could respond with deadly force. But the idea that you could respond with deadly force on the public highways or in public was absolutely not the understanding that was in place at the time the Second Amendment was written. So that more expansive and aggressive idea is a product of the 19th century. And in fact, what I found in my book, A Well-Regulated Militia, was that our modern debate about the Second Amendment has nothing to do with the 18th century, which really is about standing armies and militias and federalism and a set of debates that are peculiar to early modern political and constitutional theory, where right can be as much an obligation as it is a claim against government. Our debate, which is really a debate about gun control, about interpersonal violence and the use of laws to limit access to guns because of interpersonal violence, that is a 19th century debate. And that happens when handguns and knives become available for the first time, when we get cheap, reliable, concealable weapons between about 1830, 1840, and really picking up by the 1850s. That's when you see our modern debate between gun rights and gun control really come into being. And there's some considerable disagreement among courts. These are, of course, state laws. They're not federal laws. And they raise questions mostly about state constitutional arms-bearing provisions. But basically, we've been dealing with the problem of handguns and trying to understand it constitutionally since the age of Andrew Jackson.
How prominent was the individual rights interpretation during the founding era?
One of the things that makes this complicated is there's a lot of evidence. And one of the reasons why we have so much confusion is if you just go and take a quote and pull it out of context and don't weight it and see out of what debate that quote emerged, it's very easy to just go looking for evidence and cherry picking evidence to confirm what you already believe. So, for instance, Thomas Jefferson, who's one of the most forward looking thinkers in the 18th century, has a proposal for what he'd like the Virginia State Declaration of Rights to say about guns and arms bearing. And he says, "No free man shall be debarred the use of arms on his lands or tenements." That is a fairly broad statement of a right to have arms for personal purposes. But of course, Jefferson didn't get that into the Virginia Declaration of Rights. What we did get was George Mason's militia-based statement, which doesn't even mention the right to bear arms. So that's a good example where if we go back and we say, let's take Jefferson as the foundation for our constitutional ideas, you could construct a coherent argument for an individual right. But the question is, if you're playing the originalist game, how much do you weight Jefferson? He wasn't actually part of the Constitutional Convention. He wasn't even in America at the time the Constitution is ratified. And as James Madison found out many times, Jefferson's ideas were often avant-garde, to say the least.
Yes. And a lot of the framers were remixing Blackstone, as it were.
Yes. I mean, they're certainly, they've read their Blackstone. They've read their Hawkins' Pleas to the Crown. They've read Montesquieu. They've read all kinds of things that very few people read today, and were much the worse off for that. But they were thinking in terms of of how the militia, for instance, you often hear now, we need AK-47s or AR-15s because we need to be able to take on the government. It's the final check on tyranny. There's several problems with that interpretation of the Second Amendment. First of all, that would mean that without anyone knowing it, the Second Amendment had repealed the treason clause of the Constitution, which only defines the only crime defined in the Constitution, taking up arms against the government. So obviously the Second Amendment couldn't have repealed the treason clause. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And then if you think about Shay's Rebellion, the uprising that occurs right before the Constitution is drafted, essentially what you have is farmers in western Massachusetts who believe they can spontaneously constitute themselves as militia units and close down courts, take up arms against the government. The founders are not eager and they're not supportive of Shay's Rebellion. In fact, quite the opposite. One of the reasons we have a constitution is because Shay's Rebellion frightened the people who became the framers of our constitution. And then after the Second Amendment is adopted, in the first decade of American constitutional life, there are several popular uprisings where people try to exercise this radical right to bear arms conception.
The Whiskey Rebellion.
The Whiskey Rebellion, for instance, or Fry's Rebellion in Pennsylvania, and Gabriel's Rebellion, a slave rebellion in Richmond. The founders don't say, good boys, go at it. You know, exercise those Second Amendment rights. They send in the well-regulated militia, the militia that is the one sanctioned by law to crush these rebellions. And I might add Jefferson, who is off in France drinking Chateau Lafitte 85, you know, 1785, obviously, and having his slave chef, Madison Hemings, fix him the most delicious French pastries of the day, does write about Shay's Rebellion as if it's really nothing to get too worried about. And he does write about revolution and rebellion as though it's a good thing. Not when it's slaves rebelling in Richmond, Virginia. He doesn't embrace them. He actually supports James Monroe brutally repressing that rebellion. So the question is, will the real Thomas Jefferson stand up? Is it the man drinking Chateau Lafitte, welcoming Shay's Rebellion? Or is it the terrified person telling James Madison he must repress Gabriel's Rebellion brutally?
Yes. Well, this leads me to ask, because so many gun rights proponents today are going to tell you that a militia is very much about raising arms against the government. What were really the obligations of being a militia member in those days, and how have they changed since then? I mean, how fluid was the Second Amendment in permitting you to either take up your duty as an active member of the militia, or as you also point out in the book, during the 19th century, there's this interesting idea of, well, you can actually not exercise your militia duty by sitting it out. And that's something that I had no idea of until I read your book.
Well, this is a fascinating part of our history. We live in an era where what I like to call the Red Dawn fantasy seems to shape public debate. People have this idea that the Second Amendment is there to implement the Red Dawn fantasy. Now, in fact, the way that the Second Amendment was understood to function as a check on tyranny had nothing to do with the idea of the football team grabbing their guns and heading to the hills and taking up arms against the government.
No Wolverines.
No Wolverines. I taught at Ohio State, so no Wolverines on that front as well, since I was a Buckeye for 18 years and not a Wolverine. But that's a separate matter. What they were envisioning was these well-regulated militias, these militia statutes, which went on for pages and pages and specified what kind of gun you had and what the fines were for not reporting to muster and how your guns would be inspected. All of these government intrusions. So I like to say the Second Amendment doesn't forbid registration and other forms of government regulation. It compels it if you're true to its original spirit. I mean, how would we possibly muster the militia without something akin to registration and mandatory training? They didn't have Facebook. They couldn't just, you know, post a notice saying everyone who's got a gun who knows how to use it, you know, we're taking on these British guys. Could you show up? I mean, you had to show up. You were fined if you didn't. And exactly the kind of weapon that you were supposed to bring was specified by the law. In fact, you were obligated by the state to purchase the weapon with your own money. So it was the first unfunded federal mandate. And in a way, it presaged Obamacare because you were forced to enter the stream of commerce and buy something.
On the other hand, you do point to the example of the Quaker who doesn't want to participate in the militia and who actually is given a special permission because of the First Amendment not to actually participate in militia duties, which I found interesting from a standpoint of, well, a lot of people will say that all parts of the Constitution are whole, are equal, but in this case, it seems that the First Amendment trumped the Second.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's what I mean about forgetting that the right not to bear arms was just as important to the founders as the right to bear arms. That's the classic example, a Quaker pacifist who wouldn't be allowed by their religious beliefs to engage in any kind of martial activity. So the point that you made prior to that is there's this idea that we see several times in early America, and early on in the Risky Rebellion and later during the War of 1812, this idea that states retaining control of their militias will prevent the federal government from being able to implement a policy that the people find tyrannical. Not because anyone can shoot at the federal government, but by passively resisting the federal government. That was a very powerful idea that was certainly part of the original mix. But I think what has happened is slowly over the course of American history, that idea that that militias could function that way has been taken off the table.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if we think about the modern example, the in state militias blocking students from being enrolled in Southern institutions after court orders, what happened is the federal government federalizes the militia, and suddenly they're taking orders from the president and not the governor, and very clearly their legal obligation is to do what the president says, not what the governor says. That's quite different than the original understanding, but as I like to point out to people, we live under Lincoln's Constitution, not Jefferson Davis's. A lot of this radical Second Amendment rhetoric you hear, Second Amendment remedies and things like this, that comes out of a line that Jefferson certainly has some role to play, but that leads to Jefferson Davis, not to Lincoln. So the question is, we did fight a civil war to settle some of these issues. It's a little strange that although it is mostly Southern senators you hear this from, I suppose maybe not so strange after all, who seem to think that the Civil War didn't really happen and we're still living under that states' rights vision of the Second Amendment. But I think we took that option off the table after firing upon Fort Sumter.
Yes. I do want to actually ask you about the distinction between the militias and the U.S. Army, the U.S. having a standing army. Very famously, in the War of 1812, the British came to Washington and torched it. It was one of the most humiliating moments in national history.
Saddle us with one of the worst, hardest to sing national anthems in the world, unfortunately, in terms of musical.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it is our national anthem. We must respect it. But musically, it's made lives difficult for choruses across America for generations.
Yes, but this seems as good a time as any to draw the distinctions between what a militia meant when the Constitution emerged, what a militia meant before we had a standing army, and what a militia means after 1903 when you have a National Guard implemented reserve which replaces that militia. How has the Second Amendment changed in terms of having a well-regulated militia changed over the course of this time period?
Well, there's no question that the Second Amendment's meaning is highly sensitive to changes in military policy and thinking about the nature of the relationship between the civilian population and the military population. There's no question that we could make the founder's Second Amendment spring back to life overnight, but it would pose an enormous obligation on the citizenry. We would have to be prepared to muster at a minute's notice, drop what we were doing, report to the mall or the town green or wherever the public space would be now, and shoulder the burdens of military preparedness. Most people don't realize that at some level, the Second Amendment is part of a taxation scheme by which the cost of public defense will be transferred to individual households. And taxes generally are not popular in America, and particularly among the constituencies that seem the most radical champions of a very individualistic insurrectionary theory of the Second Amendment. I'm not sure they realize they're basically championing a theory of taxation.
Civic obligation? A theory of taxation? Report to the mall? This is all getting very complicated. I contacted Adam Winkler, a professor of constitutional law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, to get more answers on the Second Amendment. So, for a long time, federal courts declared that the Second Amendment protected the rights of states to form militias rather than this individual right to bear arms for self-defense, which most gun rights people trot off as the genuine definition. But the text of the amendment, last I checked, which was a few minutes ago, says nothing whatsoever about self-defense. So just to start off here, why have the courts made such a dramatic change only in the last few decades?
Well, we should begin with the text of the Second Amendment, which says a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. And ever since James Madison wrote those words in 1790, they've been confusing America. Americans for all those years. It's almost as if James Madison, the author of the amendment, had just discovered this wonderful new thing, the comma, and wanted to put it in there as many times as possible. While the federal courts for the last 70 years or so had interpreted the Second Amendment only to protect a right that was associated with service in state-level militias, in some ways that was different from the long-standing interpretation of the Second Amendment that had prevailed in both state constitutional law and in larger discussions about the Second Amendment. People have really been thinking the Second Amendment had created an individual right really since the early 1800s. Indeed, if we think about the Bill of Rights, all of the provisions in the Bill of Rights protect rights that are belong to individuals, not to states or other entities. So it would be kind of odd to think that when the framers of the Second Amendment put the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it would be odd to think that they meant a state when they said the right of the people to peaceably assemble. In the First Amendment, they meant people, individuals, and when they said the right of the people to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures in the Fourth Amendment, just two amendments later, that they meant something different than what they meant in the Second Amendment.
How much of the change in recent times has to do with Sanford Levinson's 1989 article, The Embarrassing Second Amendment, and how much of this also has to do with certain extremist elements that pervaded the 1977 Cincinnati NRA meeting, which you write about in the book, and which, coincidentally enough, was also featured in yesterday's Washington Post?
Well, I have to go back and look at that Washington Post article. Maybe I'll learn some more stuff about that. Very interesting transformation. Most people don't realize this, but for most of its history, the NRA was in favor of gun control. They weren't a big proponent of gun control, but they wrote and drafted and endorsed restrictive gun control laws in the 1920s and 30s that state after state after state, almost every state in the nation, adopted, making it difficult for people to carry guns in public. Those same laws the NRA takes on in court today, trying to declare them unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. There was a radical change in the gun debate in the early 1970s when the NRA was transformed into an absolutist organization, and we moved away from a view of the Second Amendment that recognized a right of individuals to have guns, but also created ample room for gun control, into a debate in which the Second Amendment was promoted by people who had a very absolutist view, an extremist view of the Second Amendment that portrayed any gun control law as a step down the slippery slope towards total disarmament.
Well, also, the interesting thing about that, too, is that in 1957, if you went to NRA headquarters, the motto near its main entrance would feature such things as firearms safety education. And speaking of that James Madison comma trick that you mentioned earlier, now it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but it misses that comma between arms and shall not.
There have been major, I think it's a nice sort of symbol of the changes that have happened in the NRA. You know, in the NRA in the 1930s, the president of the NRA was called to testify before Congress when asked about the constitutionality of the National Firearms Act of 1934, which was being deliberated, and it was the first major federal gun control law. And his answer from the perspective of today is pretty amazing. He said, when asked if the Second Amendment imposed any limits on congressional power to regulate guns, he said, "I've never given it any thought from that point of view." He, the president of the NRA, had never thought about whether the Second Amendment limited the federal government. And so I think it's telling that the NRA really has transformed quite a bit.
So we've recently seen Alex Jones rant at the top of his lungs on CNN. We've seen Gawker publicly list the names of all registered gun owners in New York from 2010. But you point out in Gunfight that people on the gun control side are also capable of hyperbole. Michael Belil, Arming America, it's this ostensible history which claims that guns were rare in early America, but this turned out to be a fabrication and was even stripped of its Bancroft Award. The 1994 federal assault weapon ban, this does not go far enough. So this leads me to ask, how much do the present talks in Washington, now underway, initiated in the wake of Sandy Hook, fit into this trend? Why can't all sides have a more realistic conversation about these very complicated issues?
Well, to be sure, there are difficulties on both sides. I mean, part of the story is that the NRA really isn't very compromising. They don't want to compromise when it comes to the Second Amendment. They've done everything they can over the last 30 years to hobble federal gun trafficking enforcement, to make it very difficult for the federal government to enact good gun control laws and then enforce them when they're enacted. And then the NRA says, well, look, see, gun control doesn't work because this gun control law you were promoting, it never was effective. But the reason why it's not effective is because it's riddled with loopholes and the enforcement is strained by a lack of resources and a lack of data that's at the insistence of the NRA. At the same time, we do see some mistakes by the gun control side. I see a lot of people who are portraying assault weapons as machine guns. We've heard about Stanley McChrystal coming out and saying that the weapons that his soldiers use shouldn't be on the streets of America, but the truth is the weapons that his soldiers use aren't on the streets of America. We don't have machine guns on the streets of America, except in very unusual circumstances. Those aren't the kinds of weapons that would be banned by an assault weapons ban.
Well, after all the recent shootings, we have seen gun proponents trot out the notion that if students or teachers or even the Aurora moviegoers only had guns, they'd be able to stop the maniacs who massacred all these people. In 1967, you have Reagan saying, shortly after the Black Panthers, there's no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying a loaded weapon. When did arming yourself in every situation become the de facto statement for a gun rights advocate? I almost thought of Thomas Frank's Pity the Billionaire, where he suggests that many of the Grover Norquist-type conservatives have adopted progressive language and taken it and made it their own. Is this sort of similar to what gun rights people have done with the Black Panthers? How did this come to mind?
I think so. There's in a couple of different ways. I mean, and one of the primary ways is that, we often think of judicial conservatives as being people who want judicial restraint. That was an old version of the conservative legal movement, but it really changed in the 1980s and early 1990s, and this is reflected in the Second Amendment, too, where conservatives started to say, you know what, we want to mimic what the Warren Court did, but we want to protect the rights that conservatives love, rights like religious freedom, a right to religious expression in the public sphere. We want the Constitution to be interpreted to protect the rights of victims of crime rather than criminal defendants, although there's, of course, no evidence that the framers of the Constitution were focused on protecting victims with the Constitution. In fact, quite the opposite. So it does happen. We do see a mimicking of older language, as conservatives have used the sort of libertarian view of the First Amendment, for example, as a model for why we should have a libertarian understanding of the Second Amendment. I think that that view of the Second Amendment, however, is very divorced from history and tradition.
Let's talk about state rights. You noted in the book that you wrote an amicus brief in Heller, and I couldn't resist but looking it up. And in that brief, you pointed out that the vast majority of state weapons regulations, ranging from the California ban on silencers to Colorado banning felons from keeping and using arms, are clearly legitimate. In Gunfight, you noted that the NRA prompted a number of states to provide these explicit guarantees for the right to bear arms: Nevada and New Hampshire in 1982, North Dakota and Utah in 1984, West Virginia 86, Nebraska 88, the list goes on. You wrote that none of the states implementing these guarantees had these restrictive gun laws beforehand, so why the need to set this all in stone? And do you have any ideas on how these guarantees can coexist with the state safety regulations?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that part of the reason why states adopted these provisions in recent years is for symbolism. So much of the gun debate is about symbolism. And I think it's on both sides. The gun rights people want even broader, ever broader statements of their right to keep and bear arms. Even though states are already protecting, 43 of the 50 states have constitutional provisions providing protections for the individual right to bear arms. And there hasn't been a serious movement to disarm Americans in a long time, and it's not likely that we're going to have one now. But even Obama, the threat that he might propose universal background checks, something that doesn't burden in any way the lawful gun owner or the lawful gun purchaser, is portrayed as a great infringement of the Second Amendment, and he's disarming Americans. There is a lot of symbolism on both sides, and I think the assault weapons ban is another example. It's clear that all the studies show that assault weapons are almost never used in crime, very, very small percentage, about 3% of crimes involve assault weapons. The assault weapons ban that was in place between 1994 and 2004 was notoriously ineffective, and yet we're talking about reinstituting this law, again, because because it's symbolism.
So going back to this rather unmeasured dialogue that's going on between the NRA and the gun control advocates, as late as 1968, the NRA actually supported the final version of the Gun Control Act, which banned mail order sales of rifles in the wake of Lee Harvey Oswald. Why did some of the conservatives and the pro-guns people turn this into a discussion where there was no compromise? When did this whole Wayne LaPierre-style colloquy become valued?
Well, it really took off after the revolution that we mentioned earlier, the NRA revolution, where the hardliners took control of the NRA overnight. And it literally was overnight. The leaders of the NRA at the time were planning on retreating from political lobbying, moving the headquarters of the NRA to Colorado Springs, and refocusing the organization on its traditional roots, marksmanship training, outdoorsman activities. And this angered a group of hardliners within the membership, including Harlan Carter, most notably. And these hardliners, they really thought that guns were about shooting criminals, not shooting ducks. And they thought that the importance was guns in the home for personal protection, even in urban environments. They staged a coup at the annual membership in 1977, where manipulating the rules of order, they took over the NRA. Literally overnight, there was a complete replacement of the board, and new hardliners committed to a more absolutist view of the NRA took hold right then and there.
Well, here in New York, we have one of the strictest gun laws in the nation, the Sullivan Dangerous Weapon Act, and if you want to have a handgun here, you need to get a permit. Now, there was this case, Quillacy versus Village of Morton Grove, where there was a handgun ban in place in this village for all but a select few. Now, the appeals court ruled that the Second Amendment only applied to a well-regulated militia back then. This was pre-1989, pre-Sanford Levinson. In 1983, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. Since I'm fortunate to talk with a professor of constitutional law, I have to ask, what chance does Heller, McDonald, and individual rights interpretations of the Second Amendment have in challenging these handgun bans?
Well, the handgun bans now have all been declared unconstitutional, so they were very effective. That's what the Heller case stood for, and then in 2000, that held that Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns and restrictions on the use of long guns for self-defense was unconstitutional. And then in 2010, in a case called McDonald versus City of Chicago, the Supreme Court held effectively that Chicago's ban on handguns was also unconstitutional, and so the city of Morton Grove had no longer has a handgun ban, and these cases have resulted in significant reform. Significantly, however, they haven't led to a lot of other reforms. There's been about a little over 300 federal court cases decided since Heller came down in 2008, challenging all sorts of different kinds of gun control laws. Very, very few laws have been struck down in the wake of the Heller case.
So the Heller case, you would say, was the major tipping point for the individual rights interpretation of the Second Amendment?
Well, major tipping point or confirmation that the things had already tipped. You know, the truth of the matter is that we didn't need the Supreme Court to tell us that that was the way Americans understood the Second Amendment. Polls showed for decades that Americans believed the Second Amendment protected a right of individuals to have guns for personal protection. And with 300 million guns out there in America, which is about the estimate of the number of guns we have, those guns aren't going anywhere. So the right to bear arms existed whether we liked it or not in some ways.
Well, let's go back to Roosevelt and the New Deal and the National Firearms Act of 1934. This act imposed very heavy taxes on machine guns and sawed-off shotguns. As you note in the book, civilian ownership of these guns became rare. It became very hard to get these weapons. There was also this registration requirement. Now, my understanding is that Haynes versus United States in 1968 put an end to this registration because it forced a felon to incriminate himself, and this, of course, is in violation of the Fifth Amendment. I'm wondering, is a national gun registry along the lines of what worked in 1934 a viable way of possibly curtailing weapons in 2013? How can any hypothetical national gun registry adhere to the Constitution?
Well, it'd be very difficult. I think most importantly, however, is it's not politically viable. There is no doubt that broad gun registration would be the best tool available to reduce gun crime. Because the problem we have today is that a gun seller can sell a gun to someone, and that person can turn around and sell it to a gangbanger or something like that, someone with criminal intent, without having to do any background check, without having to keep any records, and in fact, they can just deny that they sold the gun at all. There's no record keeping whatsoever. And so when the police find that gun at a crime scene and they go back to the original purchaser, the purchaser says, oh, I lost that gun. It was stolen. It dropped at the bottom of the lake. I have no idea what happened to it. There's no way you can prosecute those people. So gun registration would really be a helpful tool for law enforcement, but it's a non-starter right now because the gun rights movement is very firm set against this. They think that registration is a first step towards confiscation. They point to other countries where guns were registered and then confiscated as evidence that we can't allow registration because then our guns will be taken away.
Well, on the concealed carry laws, there have been studies that liberal carry laws reduce violent crime. But how reliable are these studies? I mean, the United States has a uniquely bountiful weapons supply, even if you were to implement any form of confiscation along the lines of what we're talking about, even if you could persuade people to go for it, there's a lot of weapons to take. So taken with this private sales loophole in gun legislation, Does a concealed carry law, is that more or less moot these days here in the States?
Well, it's moot in two ways. It's moot in the way that, number one, it's already the law in almost every place in the United States that you can carry a concealed firearm with a license, and you can get a license relatively easily so long as you don't have a felony conviction or you don't have some other disqualifying condition like mental illness. Still some holdouts, right? There's holdouts like Illinois, which doesn't allow any concealed carry. There's various cities like Los Angeles and New York that don't allow concealed carry very much. But for the most part, that is the question's moot in that sense. It's also moot in another sense. The people who carry concealed weapons do not commit crimes generally. That's not to say none of them do, but they don't do so at a rate higher than the average unarmed population. These are people who are usually lawful gun owners, and they're not the gun problem. The gun problem is largely a problem of suicide, which is associated directly with youth, the gun problem is largely a function of recidivist criminals and gang members, also another youth-oriented problem. The law-abiding white guy who's 50 years old and wants to carry his gun around, he's not going to affect crime rates much at all. He's not going to use his gun to commit a crime, and he's not going to use his gun to stop a crime.
But let's say there was some sort of pie-in-the-sky dream for a gun control advocate in which all guns were no longer manufactured. How much of that stockpile would possibly have to play out? I mean, how many years would it take before the guns would stop working? I mean, how much are we talking about here? Even if you banned new guns, there'd still be all these old guns, and there are so many guns out there, one wonders if it's even possible to track them all or even account for them all or even stop any problems pertaining to guns.
I don't think it is possible. And look, guns are what's known as a durable good. You can pick up a gun that was last used 80 years ago, clean it, and it'll be ready to go for you right now, barring any unforeseen circumstances. And the guns that we have today are likely to work in 200 years from now because they're very durable goods. And you know what? They're easy to make in your garage. I couldn't make one, but they're not hard to make. Look, these are products that were around before the revolution, and if they were around back then, you know that it's not hard for someone to make them today. So the existing gun stock is here to stay. I think it's the most important issue for gun policies to recognize the permanence of guns in America, and I'm hopeful that the Heller case, by recognizing the right of the people to keep and bear arms as an individual right, helps Americans to realize that the guns are here to stay, and no one's coming to get your guns. And at the same time, we can have good gun control laws without threatening people that they're going to lose their guns and Americans will be disarmed.
In Gunfight, you noted that there were some remarks that Montana was threatening to secede from the United States over the Heller decision. And I was very surprised by this, but I did go to the Gun Owners of America website you referenced in your end notes, and lo and behold, you weren't kidding. Does Montana's threat, did this represent sort of the ne plus ultra of ultimatums for gun rights? Can we expect more extraordinary actions from states in the future if we have a decision like Heller? Or was this all just a bunch of swagger?
Well, it was a bunch of swagger. dagger. There's not much doubt about that. But we are seeing that kind of extremism play out in other ways. There has been a real push among states to pass what they're calling the Firearms Freedoms Act, and it is a law to declare that federal gun control laws are unenforceable and unconstitutional within that state. So Wyoming has one of these laws, makes it a crime for federal officials to try to enforce federal gun control laws there. Now, they don't enforce that law against federal officials, and if they did, it would be struck down in a New York minute in a federal court. But these, again, as part of the battle over symbolism. I think Wyoming's already announced that that they're going to propose a law for consideration by the legislature that'll make any of the new Obama gun control laws unenforceable in the state of Wyoming.
Our final guest is Craig Whitney, a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of the book Living with Guns. Whitney is a liberal who believes that the Second Amendment should be honored. If I were to exercise my First Amendment right, Craig, and I were to level all sorts of unsettling vituperative remarks about you, your lovely wife, your family, which I'm not going to do, I'm not going to kill anybody. I may hurt your feelings, but I'm not going to kill anybody. And yet, there's an argument that others have made, and you seem to abide by, that the Second Amendment is worthy of the same defense as the First Amendment. And I'm wondering why you think that is, because we can tolerate the white supremacist who screams at the top of his lungs in Times Square, but he's not going to kill anybody. But someone with a gun is going to kill someone. So why should the Second Amendment be given the same priorities as the first?
Well, because all parts of the Constitution are equal, and you can't just ignore them unless they clearly don't apply to anything anymore. But I would point out that there is a guy, he was a radio talk jock, and his name is escaping me for the moment, he's in the book, who was convicted here in Brooklyn of threatening federal judges in Chicago with death. He used the Thomas, is it Jefferson or Madison, I don't know, somebody who said the tree of liberty needs to be watered from time to time with the blood of tyrants. After these judges had struck down a case that found that the Chicago gun ban was unconstitutional, it took the federal prosecutors three trials to finally, there were two hung juries, but on the third one he was convicted of threatening them with murder and served 36 months in jail.
But that still gets away from the question. I mean, is it really just a matter of all parts of the Constitution are equally upholdable? I mean, as time has moved on, as weapons have advanced, don't we have a duty to adjust our notions of jurisprudence? And
well, there's nothing in the Second Amendment that says that regulation is impossible, and there was always gun regulation even before the Constitution was written. In the colonies, they had gun registration and, regulations about what kind of weapons you had to have to serve in the militia, and so on. No, the question is simply, how is it interpreted today? And can regulations that make it safer with the advances in weaponry that you mentioned be devised, or should they be? And my book argues that they should be, but we can't get to an intelligent discussion of what should be done unless the two sides will talk to each other. And right now it's, the gun rights people, the NRA, says no regulation at all, it's just a ruse to make us give up our weapons. And the people who are in favor of strict gun control think that will solve all the problems of gun violence when it won't. It's human behavior that needs to be addressed as well.
You are a member of the NRA, and you couldn't even get the main man to talk with you. So it seems to me that the dialogue needs to be improved on numerous fronts.
Well, a couple of reviews have faulted me for saying the blame is shared equally by both sides when it's the NRA that's been the most the most rigid and unyielding. I think that's certainly true. It is. Well, look, Wayne LaPierre calls press conferences and doesn't let the press ask questions at them. So I wasn't really surprised when he didn't respond to my letter. He clearly is a force on his own. He doesn't need people like me writing books or journalists piping up and making objections to things he says, so he doesn't engage in dialogue.
Why is the man who has confused John Wayne's surname for his first name, why has he had this problem communicating with various people over the years? Why doesn't the NRA, if gun rights are something that are being threatened right now, surely there should be a colloquy?
Well, there should be. But his response to the president's call and to the Newtown massacre in general was to say, well, the only thing that'll prevent things like that from happening is to have guns in the hands of good people in every school. And he was at first arguing that teachers should have them. Well, this is nuts. You know, if you have teachers, if teachers did all have guns, or a lot of them did, don't you think the first thing that would happen would not be a gun massacre by some loony, but a kid discovering a gun that a teacher had left in a place where he or she shouldn't have, and then firing it by accident and killing somebody or hurting himself, the kid. You know, that's no answer. But neither is it totally ridiculous to have armed guards, people who know how to use guns and have them legally. A third of all public schools in cities in this country apparently do have them already. So it wasn't such an outrageous suggestion that LaPierre made, as the New York Times editorial found in addressing his press conference the next day.
One of the things that is very fascinating about the history of the Second Amendment is that really, until only recently, like say the last 25 years, the 1989 Yale Law Journal article you cite, The Embarrassing Second Amendment, why do you think we have had this grand shift in the last 25 years? Why has it only been only recently that suddenly the notion of self-protection is very much a part of the Second Amendment dialogue?
Right. I think it's largely due to the influence of the NRA and groups like it that have emphasized self-defense. They started doing that after the crime wave of the 60s and 70s and early 80s, when, let's face it, New York City had four times as many murders in 1992, I think it was, as we had last year, 2012. The crime rate was high 25 years ago. The NRA stirs up people's fears. That's how it raises money for membership and its lobbying activities. And the fear at the time was of rising crime and the police's inability, seemingly, to do anything about it. Well, the NRA keeps talking that way now when crime rates have fallen almost everywhere in the country by a lot because the crack epidemic came and went. And who knows, maybe it's because a lot of the people who were committing violence on the streets then are now sitting in prisons. But in any case, it's a fact. It's gone way down. But they still keep hitting people with the argument that you need a gun for self-protection because you might have a burglar come in, break your window and come in and you're asleep in bed and you lose everything, or he shoots you and kills you. It plays on fears. So the fear was real when they started doing this 25 years ago. It's artificially kept up now because the NRA refuses to recognize that crime has gone down. Or if you force them to admit it has gone down, they say, well, that's because now so many people can carry guns concealed, so criminals don't know who might be armed.
Do you believe in any sort of self-defense doctrine? Do you think that the Second Amendment should be interpreted with self-defense in mind?
The 2008 decision in the Heller case in D.C., Scalia wrote the majority opinion there, said the Second Amendment had elevated above all others the right to individual self-defense. And I say in the book, I don't see that. There's no mention of self-defense in the Second Amendment itself. It refers to a right that existed before it was written, before the Constitution was adopted, a common law right, which of course applied to self-defense as well as other things, but it did not elevate that right above all others in the Bill of Rights or in law generally.
Do you think there's a compromise to be reached for someone who wishes to hold on to a stockpile of guns, or is there sort of a maximum limit to how many arms someone can keep and bear? I mean, what do we do to appease the gun rights acolyte while simultaneously recognizing the fact that, well, there seem to be more shootings? I mean, there's Sandy Hook. I read a number of stories of shootings on New Year's Eve that horrified me. I mean, it's a reality that we have to address. I mean, certainly guns are a contributing factor, making it easier for people to kill each other.
They are. Most of the gun violence and most of the murders that are committed with guns are not committed with those assault rifles, though, like the one that was used in Newtown, but with handguns. In many cases, crimes are committed with handguns using extended magazines that let you carry more than 10 rounds.
Yeah.
and therefore fire more than 10 times.
Semi-automatic pistols like Glocks and so forth.
And don't forget, assault rifles are also semi-automatic, not fully automatic. It seems to me that of all the proposals that I've heard of to deal with this problem, dealing with extended magazines might be the simplest and the first easiest way to go at it. Perhaps those should be forbidden or registered or limited so that you can't just go out and purchase, you know, 100 of them or go back to the assault weapons ban from 94 to 04 that they were forbidden. But they loophole the law, allowing anybody who'd bought one already to keep it. So Joe Biden's committee that Obama appointed him to head will surely be discussing that. Dianne Feinstein says she's going to introduce, maybe as soon as Congress reconvenes, a measure that would fill in all the loopholes in the assault weapons ban and try to reinstate it. I don't see how that would be adopted as is, but it might provide the basis for a real discussion, and it will be a fight, you know, let's face it, about what can be done to limit these horrible events like Newtown. We can't just do nothing, because if we do, there's going to be another one, inevitably. You know, I wrote that in the book before Newtown, and look what happened. It's not that I predicted it, but these things are going to keep happening until we do something.
Has Newtown changed your position on guns at all?
No, it confirms what I was saying, that we can't do nothing. I do agree, though, that we can't fall back into the old patterns, which the book is an attempt to break, of, you know, on the one hand, take all the guns away, on the other hand, resist all regulation, it's an attempt to take our guns away. That stalemate has to be broken. We have to talk about the real problem of gun violence. And there are ways to address, make these things less likely to happen by keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, who everybody agrees shouldn't have them. Like, for instance, closing the so-called gun show loophole.
Yeah.
I can be a criminal and buy a gun from a private seller without my name ever going through the national check system that would keep me from buying a gun if I went to a gun dealer. Well, that's nuts. You know, we should close that loophole. Never mind what the NRA says. Are you crazy? 40% of all gun sales may be private sale.
Yes. Not to mention straw purchasers, which you also address in the book. It is mind-bogglingly easy, it seems, for any criminal or any person with mental problems to get a gun if he wants to. So the question is I'm wondering if it's even possible to have a series of checks and balances that would make it more difficult to purchase guns, or maybe we need to reconsider how many guns are on the market. You know what I mean?
We ought to consider registries. I don't think a federal registry is the answer, but each state ought to have a registry. And they did have them in the colonies.
Yeah.
You know, so NRA is full of you know what when they say registration is the first step to confiscation. Come on. It's been with us since earliest times. It's only lately that they've gotten legislatures to pass laws forbidding registration. They do have in several states such laws.
But the Second Amendment is only the beginning in understanding how guns pervade American culture. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of this week's program. But tune in next week when our discussion of guns continues. We'll talk with a survivor of a gun-related crime, find out how large magazine Glocks became so ubiquitous in American culture, and share our ongoing efforts to have conversations with those who believe that guns should be the center of 21st century life. Until then, we encourage you to follow your ears. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. Our thanks to the people of the Bronx, Porchies to Cockpore, Saul Cornell, Adam Winkler, and Craig Whitney. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. Thank you for listening.